And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza.
You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
That does it for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. Our theme music is written and produced by Charlie Lang. For questions, comments, email Dennis Bernstein at dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
Mr. No, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM. You don't know.
It's time to pack your bags and join us for Camp KBOO. Make a summer of memories with KBOO and support grassroots media by becoming a member today. Go to kboo.fm/give to help us reach our $50,000 goal by June 29th.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communication Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground.
Good morning and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, your volunteer-powered, member-supported, nonprofit community radio station. I'm Fran Michelle, reminding you that this is the last week of the Camp KBOO Summer Membership Drive, focusing on our vast community and the memories we'll make. We only have a few days left to reach our $50,000 goal, so please help us get there. Donate today at kboo.fm/give, or if you're using the KBOO mobile app, just click on the donate button to support community-powered radio. Today's episode looks at war and grief and the value of community in our struggles with both of those things. On June 13th, the U.S. Army swore in four Silicon Valley executives from high-tech firms Meta, OpenAI, and Palantir at the rank of Lieutenant Colonel to serve in the new Detachment 201, an executive innovation corps dedicated to integrating further into the military what's misleadingly called artificial intelligence, also formerly known as machine learning. They won't have to go through basic training, but they will be expanding the software and hardware programs that their companies have already begun. To learn more about this trend, we revisit an interview from earlier this year. Lori Mercier talks with Roberto J. Gonzalez, a professor of anthropology at San Jose State University. His most recent book is War Virtually: The Quest to Automate Conflict, Militarize Data, and Predict the Future. And he talks with Lori about how Silicon Valley is transforming the military-industrial complex. Then we turn to remembering the life and work of one of Portland's most important organizers working to stop state violence, including war, militarism, and policing. Dan Handelman, founding member of Portland Peace and Justice Works and Portland Cop Watch, worked indefatigably on a host of interconnected issues, including civil rights and police accountability, and died unexpectedly in April. Desiree Helligers, a former longtime board member of Peace and Justice Works, talks about Dan's organizing legacy with civil rights attorney Ashley Albies and with Seemab Husseini, a former member of the Portland Police Accountability Commission, an activist with Freedom to Thrive. On June 28th, friends and comrades will gather at the Clinton Street Theater from 10 to noon to honor Dan Handelman's life and work. You can find a link to RSVP and reserve a seat by going to the webpage for this episode of the Old Mole Variety Hour at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Finally today, we turn to reviews of two books about surviving the griefs of losing our beloved comrades in the struggle for a more just world, or simply of navigating the grievous state of the current world, and about the hope to be found in community. Matt Witt reviews Truth Demands, a memoir of murder, oil wars, and the rise of climate justice by lawyer, climate activist, and writer Abby Reyes, whose partner, Terence Unity Freitas, was assassinated in Colombia while working with the indigenous Uwa community to protect their land and their rights from multinational oil interests. And Patricia Kullberg reviews Rebecca Solnit's latest collection of essays, No Straight Road Takes You There, Essays for Uneven Terrain. All that's coming up on the Old Mole here on KBOO Portland. We turn now to Lori Mercier talking with anthropologist Roberto Gonzalez about how Silicon Valley is transforming the military-industrial complex.
Good morning. This is Lori Mercier, and I'm speaking to Roberto Gonzalez, a professor of anthropology at San Jose State University, whose recent work has focused on militarization and culture in the United States. He's the author of many articles and books, including Anthropologists in the Public Sphere, Speaking Out on War, Peace, and American Power, American Counterinsurgency, Human Science and the Human Terrain, Militarizing Culture, Essays on the Warfare State, and most recently, War Virtually, The Quest to Automate Conflict, Militarize Data, and Predict the Future. He's working on a new book about algorithmic policing in the United States. Today, we're talking about how Silicon Valley is transforming the military-industrial complex. Welcome to KBOO, Roberto Gonzalez.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you've written about how big tech is increasingly fused with the military-industrial complex. Tell us how and why this happened.
Well, what's happening now is part of a much longer process that began in the 1950s with the emergence of the Silicon Valley region as a major site for R&D that was largely financed by the U.S. military and intelligence agencies during the Cold War. Silicon Valley and the United States as a whole has this image of the region as a place that was built up by these savvy, independent, maverick entrepreneur engineers who built fantastic new technologies like semiconductors and the internet with their own genius, largely self-funded. That's not the case at all. In fact, the entire region developed largely through Cold War funding. For decades, the largest employer in the area was not Atari or Apple or Ampex. It was Lockheed Martin. And Lockheed Martin continues to be a very large economic power in the region. So what's happened over the past 20 years or so is that you have a new generation of companies that collectively we call big tech that include household names like Microsoft, Google, Oracle, Amazon, some of which are not even based in the San Francisco Bay Area or Silicon Valley, but collectively are still described as Silicon Valley. And what's happened with these big tech firms over the past 10 years in particular is that they've become more and more invested in seeking out large multi-year, multi-billion dollar Pentagon contracts. So that's really what I've been most interested in documenting is the recent phase in this long-term process of the militarization of the tech industry that really stretches back to its origins.
Now, you trace this more recent marriage, I suppose, back to 2011 when President Obama authorized the drone strike that assassinated Anwar al-Awlaki, a U.S.-born Muslim cleric. And although Obama and subsequent administrations and the Department of Defense have touted the drone's precision, as you document, the so-called advanced technology presents many problems. What are some of the problems associated with drone warfare?
Right. Well, I think to understand some of the problems, one needs to put this in, again, in historical perspective. The period between 2011 and 2015 or 2016 was critical for the emphasis on a new form of high tech, or what at the time was called data-driven warfare. The historical context is this, that it emerged at a time when it was becoming increasingly clear that the United States military's commitment to the Petraeus era counterinsurgency model, boots on the ground, social scientists on the ground, a kind of throwback almost to Vietnam era counterinsurgency tactics, that strategy was failing by 2010, 2011. And so the Obama administration came in and began to explore new, really tech-focused alternatives to classic counterinsurgency. And what developed out of that was what some have called computational counterinsurgency. So basically using all kinds of big data collected from drones, surveillance drones, collected from other kinds of sensors, from satellites, from internet usage patterns, from cell phone patterns, and really just crunch those numbers to come up with lists of potential terrorists or potential insurgents. And what emerged out of that were these kinds of essentially hit lists. And because these wars in Afghanistan and Iraq were becoming increasingly unpopular with Americans and U.S. troop casualty counts were increasing, drone warfare, or one way of thinking of this is war by remote control, became more and more popular during the 2010s. The advantages, of course, are potentially the fewer deaths of U.S. servicemen and women. But the downside, as we know from lots of investigative reports that have been done since that time, is that it also resulted in large numbers of civilian casualties in Iraq, Afghanistan, and other theaters in the war on terror. So that is the big downside. Apart from that, apart from the sheer violence of civilian casualties, large numbers of civilian casualties, numbering in the tens of thousands if we add up Iraq and Afghanistan together, then there's also a psychological component. And we know quite a lot now about the negative psychological impact of drone warfare on people, perhaps who were never physically hurt by this war by remote control, but for years carried this burden of fear and terror of being constantly subjected to surveillance and potential violence inflicted by drones. Interestingly, and this is, I think, less well known to the public, drone warfare has also, at least in its remote controlled form, led to significant patterns of mental health problems among U.S. drone crews. Now, for years, critics of drone warfare said, well, you know, these troops are just, they're like video gamers, right? I mean, they're basically killing with impunity and doing so without any compunction or sense of guilt. In reality, it turns out, now that there's been quite a bit of research on this, drone warfare has had a serious psychological impact on drone crews themselves. I'm talking about, again, U.S. servicemen and women from the Air Force who are essentially pulling the trigger from thousands of miles away without fully knowing whether or not their actions will result in civilian casualties or not. So what's emerged out of this is patterns of post-traumatic stress disorder, not too much unlike what one might expect from troops on the ground physically in a battle space, in an actual battle space, as opposed to a virtual one.
And that's despite the military's training of these drone technicians to thinking that these are merely video games. I mean, isn't much the training about creating this kind of video game atmosphere?
Yes, that's essentially a part of the training, as I understand it, is that it's the kind of classic training that I think all modern military personnel go through, not just in the US, but in other countries, which is the dehumanization and the objectification of the target. What's interesting in the case of remote control drone warfare, which continues to be the primary use of drones, as opposed to, say, autonomous or fully autonomous drones that pick their own targets. But when it comes to remote control, you've got a paradox, essentially. So you've got, on the one hand, an increase in the distance between the target and the killer. On the other hand, you've got a compression of space to the extent that the drone crews are sometimes monitoring a target for days or weeks at a time, with a fine enough video resolution that they can see that this person living the details of their everyday life as they go from one area to another, as they go on outings perhaps with their families or friends, as they engage in community activities, so that they begin to see the target themselves as an actual person despite the far geographic distance. And that is very likely the cause of the PTSD, is the psychological proximity that this kind of drone warfare brings with it.
I don't know if you've seen the powerful recent film From Ground Zero, which includes 22 short films by different filmmakers about life in Gaza during warfare. But in each of the 22 films, or short films, there's the constant buzzing sound of drones overhead. So it was very striking to me that no one in Gaza can escape the terrifying sights and sounds of 24/7 drone surveillance. But despite this targeted surveillance and so-called advanced technology, for the last 15 months, Israel has indiscriminately dropped U.S.-made bombs on families in tents, hospitals, ambulances, everywhere and everyone. So what is the argument about Israel's so-called superior technology if the results, genocide, are the same as 20th century warfare?
That is the question. I think that is the reason that I'm so critical of where things are headed. I mean, despite the continuing rhetoric about the advanced technology leading to greater and greater surgical precision, to use one of the phrases that, for example, the Defense Department had long used, or the kinds of claims that the Israeli Defense Ministry has made about the accuracy and precision of its strikes, on the ground, the reality is, as you say, in Gaza, many, many civilian casualties, primarily women and children, the razing of entire communities, the destruction of key infrastructural, you know, hospitals, electricity grids, that kind of thing. I think what makes the war in Gaza quite strikingly different from the U.S. war on terror is the fact that Israel, this has now been widely reported, has been using a number of artificial intelligence-enabled technologies. And what this has led to, and I think this is what we should all be concerned about, is the acceleration of warfare, so that the vast scale of both physical as well as infrastructural destruction in a place like Gaza is partially the result of the acceleration of the attacks. So what AI does is to speed things up. It means that decisions are made automatically, autonomously in some cases, with such rapidity that there is not enough time for a human actor to intervene if, for example, there's some kind of an error in the data coming in. And so this is something I think that we should all be paying attention to. And it's happening if we look beyond the war in Gaza, if we look beyond the war in Ukraine, if we think about the global geopolitical context of what some people call an AI arms race between the United States and China. Well, in many ways, we're back to a kind of Cold War nuclear arms race kind of mentality. And again, I think this is something that we should all be paying attention to, be concerned about, be in contact with our elected officials about our concerns, because there is, a level of fear and also, frankly, hype around this idea of an AI arms race and the need for the United States to remain the world's, you know, sole superpower, et cetera, that's driving this, that it can become a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Well, I now understand why you have been so critical about big tech's entry into, you know, the longstanding arena of the Pentagon's horribly bloated and corrupt budget, which includes a revolving door between Congress and Department of Defense officials and boards of military contractors. So the big tech entry has, it sounds like, has really raised the level of danger of the future of warfare. And why are these contracts so secret? And how have they evaded scrutiny?
Well, a lot of these contracts are classified contracts. And, you know, I think the argument is because the technologies are so new, or the uses are so sensitive in terms of national security, that the details in terms of the amounts of the contract should not be publicized, nor the details about what the contracts are for. The CIA, of course, has a long history of working in a classified fashion. The CIA, unlike the military, reports to the executive branch directly. So there's all kinds of political reasons in terms of why those budgets continue to be classified. But beyond that, I mean, there's even for those contracts that are not classified, if one is doing research on the contracts themselves, it's an incredibly complex and confusing process. Because let's say you have a $10 billion contract that's spread out over a five-year period that's divided up between two major contractors. Each of those major contractors may well have 5 or 10 or 15 subcontractors that it then parcels the work out to. So it very quickly becomes a complicated picture to get precise dollar amounts or to get a precise picture of what exactly a particular company is working on within a larger framework. The person that I know in the institution, the organization that I think is doing the best work in this area, and I encourage all of your listeners to check it out, there's a nonprofit research group called Tech Inquiry, and their website is techinquiry.org. And they've got a fantastic resource, which is a searchable database of military contracts that is greatly useful to researchers, reporters, and the citizens as a whole, anybody interested in this topic, so that you can search, for example, a particular company like Anduril Industries or Palantir or Google, and find out what contracts they've gotten, at least technically how they're listed in the congressional budget reports. And this is all essentially, it's aggregating openly accessible information and putting it in one place. The person that got this off the ground, he's a very interesting person by the name of Jack Paulson. He's a doctor of mathematics. He's a former senior scientist at Google, and then decided to quit his job, I believe in 2017 or 2018, as the first widely publicized Google military contracts came to light. And he caught my attention because of an op-ed he wrote in the New York Times titled, "I used to work for Google, but I don't anymore. I'm a conscientious objector," or something along those lines. And what he did with his career in his post-Google career is just fascinating in terms of doing the general public and the taxpayers a great service by putting his mathematical skills to work to do a kind of public interest database on military industrial contracts in the tech sector.
Thanks for that recommendation. And we will link to it on the KBOO website. This is Lori Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio. I'm speaking with Professor Roberto Gonzalez, professor at San Jose State University, about how big tech and Silicon Valley are transforming the military-industrial complex. Well, Professor Gonzalez, we've seen Elon Musk shadowing Trump for months, and now the other tech billionaires have joined the Trump bandwagon. What's the significance of their influence? I mean, already with major DoD contracts.
Well, it's hard to know for sure. You know, we're talking about, apart from people with very large companies that they manage, that they direct, also with very large egos. And given the fact that someone like Elon Musk and President Trump, although they may be getting along fine now, it's hard to say what their relationship might look like 6 months from now. What I will say is that apart from Elon Musk, there are many, many other tech executives that have very quickly aligned themselves with the Trump administration. During the campaign, you know, there was some interest by the press on people like Peter Thiel, who co-founded Palantir Industries, and Palmer Luckey, who is the CEO of Anduril Industries, which is another tech company very much invested in AI technologies and becoming increasingly important in the business of Pentagon contracts. And then also you've got a number of people from the venture capital world. And it's important not to leave the VC investors out of this discussion either. Venture capital, of course, you know, these are financiers, big time investors who are looking for oftentimes startup companies, small startups, so that they can fund these. And then if the small startups either get acquired or go public, become publicly traded corporations, then that VC investment pays off big time. And Trump, interestingly, drew quite a bit of funding from some of the big venture capital firms, most notably Andreessen Horowitz is one of the biggest two VC firms. So the connection here is that the venture capital world has increasingly pumped money into small defense tech startups, so that apart from the big tech companies, you know, the SpaceX, Elon Musk's firm, Google, Microsoft, and these companies, you've got literally dozens and dozens of small startups funded by these largely Silicon Valley-based venture capital funds. So they're jumping on board very quickly. I think they're going to have a huge influence in shaping U.S. military policy. You know, one could say that it was that this has been long overdue, that the legacy, the old defense firms were just too stuck in the past, stuck in their ways, and that this is what the Pentagon needs. But I have many concerns about where this is headed, not just because of artificial intelligence and AI-enabled weapon and surveillance systems, but also because of the lack of transparency that I think will come along with this inevitably. And the forms of accelerated warfare that we're likely to see going forward.
Yeah, if Gaza and Ukraine are indicators of just the killing fields that are created by this kind of warfare. And even though the face of the military-industrial complex is changing, as you indicate, this is still a huge drain on the public treasury, the U.S. military budget, which all of these capitalists lining up to feed at the trough will at least continue, if not accelerate. And so what, Professor Gonzalez, as an anthropologist, do you have to offer in terms of thinking about how we replace the war-based economy and culture with one that is peace-based?
Well, I'm glad you asked this question. It's a great question. And this is partially why I got into this area, which is fairly uncommon, I think, for a cultural anthropologist to dive into the world of the military-industrial complex. Of course, as you mentioned earlier, my position is very critical. And my critical perspective and my criticism is largely informed by my experience in having the opportunity to live in societies that are very different from ours and to learn from them. And so, you know, if we take one example, we can travel to most Western European countries and find that if you've traveled at all through a place like the Netherlands, for example, you find that the infrastructure is just, for example, the train system to get from one area to another, very efficient, very inexpensive. There's all kinds of elements of infrastructure, elements of public education. There are other ways that tax dollars can be spent other than this massive military outlay, which is now in approximating $1 trillion or approaching $1 trillion a year in the United States. But think of how all of that could be used to invest in other parts of our society. Again, education, the healthcare system, climate change mitigation, you name it. All of these alternatives are being squandered because of the huge amounts of taxpayer money that have gone to the military-industrial complex. In the past, you know, the Lockheed Martins and the Boeings and the BA Systems and the Raytheons. In the future, very likely, the Microsofts and the Amazons and the Googles. So this, is, of course, is a huge concern. And creating a peace-based economy, I think, is going to take all of us raising those questions, making those criticisms, thinking about those alternatives, creating our own alternatives locally as well, if our federal government is not going to provide the support that we need. I think also that the incentive structures need to change. I think we as a society need to think about how to make a peace-based economy. What are these incentives for doing that? What are the incentives that will get our politicians diverting more of those funds away from defense and towards the kinds of real human needs that our society has?
Well, thank you so much. And I know locally that the Oregon Investment Council is meeting and lots of folks are planning to call attention to the Oregon Investment Council's investments in war-producing industries and Israel bonds and so on to try to redirect those investments to more productive uses. And often on this show, I recommend the Cost of War Project, which I know, Roberto, you have published, or you're a fellow of the Brown University Cost of War Project, and also the National Priorities Project, where people can look up how tax dollars coming from Oregon could be redirected into public housing, education, food assistance, all kinds of more positive uses, social uses. So thanks so much for joining us today, Roberto Gonzalez. We'll link to some of your work on the Old Mole Variety Hour page on the KBOO website. Thanks again.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Lori. I was happy to talk with you.
Thanks a lot. We can chase down all our enemies, bring them to their knees. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace.
That was Michael Franti performing Bomb the World, and that was Lori Mercier talking with anthropologist Roberto Gonzalez about big tech in the military and how to work against it. I'm Fran Michelle. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, and I want to thank everyone who has called on the Oregon Investment Council to follow its own policies, and thank everyone who's been working for peace and justice in all possible ways, and thank everyone who has supported Camp KBOO's summer membership drive to help us keep getting the word out to our communities. Visit us at kboo.fm, and while you're there, be sure to click on that donate button. This is the last week of our drive, so give now, and thank you. We turn now to hearing about someone whose life was dedicated to creating community, organizing for peace and justice. Here's Desiree Hilligers with memories of Dan Handelman.
In these pre-taped interviews, Ashley Albies and Seemab Husseini reflect back on memories of the late Dan Handelman and of the epic struggle that played out in Portland in the aftermath of 9/11 as activists mobilized to shut down the Portland Joint Terrorism Task Force. Nationwide, joint terrorism task forces see city police deputized as FBI agents in the absence of any meaningful local oversight. The historical struggle to shut down the Portland Joint Terrorism Task Force holds important lessons for the contemporary criminalization of Palestinians and critics of the unfolding genocide in Gaza. Albies and Husseini reflect back on the critical role that Handelman, who grew up in a reformed Jewish household, played in the David and Goliath struggle.
I appreciate this kind of retrospective or look at all the work that Dan Handelman had done for our community. His legacy is going to continue. I think about him on an almost weekly basis, especially now with what's going on with policing and what's continuing to go on with the outbreak of war and beating the drums of war, and knowing that his work was so deeply felt to him and how he tirelessly organized around anti-war protests and the crackdown on civil liberties, and being really clear and concise in his organizing and making connections between what's happening internationally and what is happening locally. In looking back through some of the history of his engagement with the Joint Terrorism Task Force, in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, there was a lot of anti-Muslim sentiment and a focus on targeting quote-unquote Muslim extremists. And this was really before understanding what had happened with 9/11 and what the mechanisms were and what the backdrop was. And I moved to Portland in 2002. So my first kind of engagement with Dan Handelman and Portland Cop Watch was not until after 9/11, but pretty soon after starting law school at Lewis and Clark, became aware of the organ work that Portland Cop Watch was doing. There was anti-war protests all over Portland. And I was a legal observer with the National Lawyers Guild as a law student. And Dan was kind of behind the scenes organizing quite a bit. From my perspective, as I was just beginning to understand the kind of lay of the land of Portland activism. But he was very present when we were doing anti-war organizing. He was always a resource for folks that were already in the National Lawyers Guild and in the Oregon ACLU and people that were organizing around anti-war movements and anti-war work and promoting peace. It wasn't just anti-war, it was also pro-peace. And part of that included how we engaged with each other. And Dan was always respectful and had a tremendous amount of knowledge and was always willing to be a resource for people about his depth of knowledge and about the political landscape. And he did so in a way that was very respectful and polite and not, I know better than you, but I have a lot of information. If you want it, I'm happy to share that. And just that, the way he showed up in those spaces was peaceful and respectful and promoting community, promoting collaboration. And I think that's really a part of why so many of us in the community trusted him and worked with him. He knew what he was talking about, and he didn't speak out of turn, and he listened and he collaborated. And that was a very important dynamic and dimension to his personality, and why folks wanted to work with him and why folks felt comfortable approaching him when we needed information or insight or thoughts on strategy. I first really started working more with Dan in 2005. So in 2001, he was part of, with Portland Clapwatch, was organizing and advocating with the ACLU and a lot of other local organizations on non-cooperation with the JGTF. And at that time, there was a lot of community pushback because people felt worried and scared, and the Muslim community in Oregon had been targeted, and that these were our community members and our neighbors. And so a lot of Portland organizers and community members came out to push back against joining the JTTF because there was this unchecked and frankly scary prospect of people being picked up in the streets. And this is what's happening today too with immigration, with ICE. But it felt like a lawlessness of that, just fear. And the federal government was stoking the fans of fear about the Muslim community in ways that were completely inappropriate and inaccurate, and trying to be very divisive. But I think the Portland community, from my perspective, came together and tried to organize and support each other. And Dan was a very important part of that effort. When I first really started working with Dan was in 2005. So after the 2001 efforts to pull out of the JTTF, that was ultimately unsuccessful. But in 2005, there was a large coalition that came together. And this was in the wake of a Portland imam who had, I think, been detained at the airport. There was like this specter of having explosives found on his luggage or something. And ultimately, that didn't turn out to be true. But it was just this heightened sense of, again, Muslims being targeted in these unfair ways. And also, it was the wake of Brandon Mayfield had been detained based on a faulty false partial fingerprint. And he was a Muslim attorney in Portland and had means and access, and still he was detained. And there was no connection that he had to any kind of terrorism or extremist organizations. And just the fact that he was Muslim was a connection that the FBI drew to terrorism and then detained him for quite some time. So it was in the wake of this that I think the Portland community came together, including our Muslim community members, to really point out the flaws in the federal government and the FBI's drawing connections that didn't exist, and that puts us all at risk. And I think the feds believed that many people in this country, as they had post 9/11, would distance themselves from their Muslim community members. But in Portland, there was a very strong showing of togetherness and coordination, which I think was very powerful. And so in 2005, I do remember with organizing with Dan around this, he would often talk about this very loose definition of terrorism and extremism, because we know that they might be connecting and starting with Muslim extremists, but they very quickly move to progressive movements, environmental movements.
At that point, there have already been substantial revelations of police spying in Portland going back to the 80s.
Right. So using the history of police spying, and of course, in Oregon, we have this statute that prohibits political surveillance of people based on their political activity and retaining that information, which, you know, Dan would always put that statute out in the forefront and talk about the basis for that. And the underlying reasons for the passage of that law was because of a history of spying on political movements, a history of police gathering surveillance data and intimidating activists and organizers.
And PJW, Portland Cop Watch, was targeted.
Right. So Dan would organize and like talk about and point to specific actions of the violations of civil liberties that we had seen both local and federal government engage in, and the detriment to our community around that. And making those ties between the targeting of members of our community that were Muslim and eventually the targeting of people engaged in direct action or people engaged in environmental protests, and using this umbrella of terrorism in 2005, when the Portland City Council voted to remove us from the JTTF, we were the first city in the country to do that, to sever ties with the JTTF because of the lack of connection, because of the over surveillance, because of the over policing of the Muslim community, and making connections that weren't there that were very detrimental to community members and communities in their entirety. And that was a really, really important organizing effort. And Dan was a constant resource and constantly building connections and showing up in solidarity and with support. And Portland Cop Watch was very instrumental in the withdrawal of Portland from the JTTF in 2005. And it was based on evidence, based on information, based on facts. And those at that time were difficult for Portland City Council members and community members to turn away from and reject, because we had the facts that were there showing that there had been these repeated violations. And it was not in our best interest to continue to engage in the Joint Terrorism Task Force.
Seemab Husseini also shared memories of organizing with Dan Handelman.
I actually started organizing professionally as a career, as an actual choice about 10 years ago. And it was around then that I met Dan. It was kind of like one of those things where it's like, oh, well, you're scratching in this field. You know, you're talking about police accountability. You're talking about holding law enforcement accountable when it comes to this realm that was very few minds that you'd refer to as experts, particularly ones that are kind of like an institutional expert. One of my first jobs as an organizer was working at Unite Oregon as a Multnomah County organizer, but also around the same time founding the Oregon chapter for the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE, the Oregon CARE chapter. Around that time, it's like you're jumping into organizing, you're taking on very, very huge topics right off the bat. You know, civil liberties, civil rights issues for Muslim communities. A lot of them were being violated in so many different ways over a decade since 9/11. You've had the Portland 7. You had all kinds of things taking place. So I found that rather than reinventing the wheel, acknowledging those that have done the work and are continuing to do the work before you, be the best place to start. And meeting Reverend Dr. Leroy Haynes, as well as Dan Handelman, came to the top of my list very quickly. My meeting with Dan Handelman wasn't necessarily a networking opportunity, more than like, okay, great, good to meet you. Well, here's some work to do. It was immediate. He put you in the line of work. He was like, okay, well, you know, if you're willing to do some stuff and this is the subject matter, well, this is what we're currently working on, a JTTF coalition. And he plugged me into that. And that was my very first time really getting in there. And it was a very hot campaign. Muslim communities were in the thick of, and that's when I really, really kind of got to know like Dan's mind and his brain, at least introduced to it around that time. And the adoration and reverence was immediate. He mastered understanding processes in Portland. He was encyclopedic. He did not care to be a character as much as he kind of was in his way. He did not care to be a character more than he cared to see the work through, connect with as many people that would help that process move forward. And I remember like in those days being warned of Dan by organizers, like, you know, careful, he's very much into himself and his own head. I didn't see any truth. Through experience, he really understood history. He really understood exactly what systems were at play here in Multnomah County, in Portland, and in Oregon, and had a sense of clarity and purpose when it came to being like, okay, let's address this issue and let's move forward with it. And people saw that as arrogance, and I was completely floored. I saw abject wisdom.
I feel like in a lot of ways, he was trying to, as you said, like trying not to be the focus. And if you look at other pictures or video of Dan, you know, in earlier years, I mean, he came from this theater background. He was a carpenter in the theater, so he wasn't actually on the stage. But he really had a kind of comic shtick. He was very funny. And I think he had to work hard to not become the center of attention. And I think that was easily misread.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he was a stage manager, you know, for for what was happening. He'd done the work in the background so well. He understood like the facade that Portland posed, and he understood exactly how they maintained the rhetoric politically. I grew up playing with stage crew in high school a little bit. I grew up having really good friends do this style of work, and like looking at him and the way he see things as scaffolding behind the play is exactly was his approach, trying to basically make sure that, you know, as organizers, we're playing against a system that does not want to see it corrected. Right. Mm-hmm. And to do that, you really have to understand how it's thoroughly built. And you have to understand that scaffolding that, that holds it together. And it was very difficult for me to really see like what we're up against until I started organizing with Dan.
You've been listening to an interview with Seemab Husseini, founder of the Oregon chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations, and with civil liberties and rights attorney Ashley Albies. They've been speaking about the struggle to shut down the Portland Joint Terrorism Task Force and about the organizing legacy of Dan Handelman. Stay tuned in July for a follow-up segment featuring Debbie Iona, organizer with the Portland chapter of the League of Women Voters. This has been Desiree Helgers for the Omo Variety Hour.
If you see me stumble, look on, reach out now, brother, give your hands to struggle.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock performing Give Your Hands to Struggle. And that was Desiree Helligers talking with Ashley Albies and Seemab Husseini about the life and legacy of Dan Handelman, who gave his hands to the struggle. You can find out more about the memorial event coming up on Saturday, June 28th, by visiting the webpage for this episode of The Old Mole at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. While you're there, you can join the community supporting Camp KBOO's summer membership drive and help us make our $50,000 goal before this last week of the drive is out by clicking on the red donate button. Thank you so much to everyone who has given and everyone who's helped out by sharing the word. You can also donate by texting KBOO to 44321 or by mailing a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Next, we hear from Matt Witt about the book Truth Demands, a memoir of murder, oil wars, and the rise of climate justice by lawyer and climate activist Abby Reyes.
We live in a time when many people are wondering how to maintain their sense of hope, how to keep taking action against injustice, and not be paralyzed by the powerful forces aligned against us. Abby Reyes, a longtime environmental activist, shares some insights about that in her new book, Truth Demands. When Reyes was 25 years old, her life partner, Terence Freitas, was also her work partner. They both spent their days supporting indigenous people in Colombia who were opposing destruction of their land by a multinational oil company. Freitas felt that the work required that he take a trip to rural Colombia, a dangerous trip given that the oil company and its political allies had a strong motive to use any means necessary to put a stop to the opposition. While in Colombia, Freitas and two others were brutally murdered. Reyes was suddenly confronted with a whole array of emotions: grief at losing her partner, anger that he put himself and others at risk, guilt that she survived while Freitas and the others did not, conflict with the family of one of the other victims, and a deep frustration that the Colombian government prevented accountability for those who ordered the murders. As with so many before me, Reyes writes, the murders forced me to learn basic practices for moving through grief and ambiguity that otherwise might have taken a lifetime to learn. Reyes' book intertwines two stories. One is her continued work for answers about the murders and for climate justice, drawing on what she has learned from the indigenous people of Colombia. Her current work includes, for example, supporting efforts by immigrant communities in Southern California to form urban farms, land trusts, and worker-owned cooperatives. For decades, she writes, I have worked for a vision of the future in which we transition as a species from economies of extraction, militarism, and exploitation, conditions that lead to murders like this in the first place, to regenerative and resilient living economies of interdependence. The other story in Truth Demands is her personal search for a way to carry on despite the greed and violence we often face. We must turn to each other, not on each other, she writes. We must learn to rest, to forgive ourselves and others, and to draw strength from the earth and its waters. Truth Demands is a dramatic account of one person's life journey, but at a difficult time for many of us, Reyes's book also shares important wisdom that she has gathered along the way.
Venenos tus monólogos, tus discursos incoloros. No ves que no estamos solos. Millones de polo a polo, al son de un solo coro. Marcharemos con el tono, con la convicción que basta de robo. Tu estado de control, tu trono podrido de oro. Tu política y tu riqueza y tu tesoro. No, la hora sonó, la hora sonó. No permitiremos más, más tu doctrina del shock. La hora sonó, la hora sonó. La hora sonó, la hora sonó.
That was Anna Tijoux performing Shock, and that was Matt Witt describing Truth Demands, a memoir of murder, oil wars, and the rise of climate justice by Abby Reyes. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Fran Michel, and this is the last week of Camp KBOO's summer membership drive. Thank you to everyone who's followed that wisdom to turn to each other, toward our community, by contributing to KBOO. You can join us by going to kboo.fm/give, or by clicking on the red donate tab on the website or in the KBOO app. Now we hear from Patricia Kullberg about Rebecca Solnit's latest essay collection, No Straight Road Takes You There, Essays for Uneven Terrain, about the necessity of hope and the unpredictability of the future.
We commonly greet each other with the question, how are you? In these times, it turns out to be a highly fraught question. Lately, I've resorted to a split answer. On a very personal level, I'm fine, I say, no complaints. But, I go on, I find our rapid descent into fascism distressing, to put it mildly. In fact, I'm struggling to fend off a sense of despair. And whomever I'm speaking with nods their head, yes, they are depressed and anxious too. It's a daily struggle to retain a sense of hope. It's a great time then to read a new book by Rebecca Solnit, who has made a long-term project of writing about the necessity of finding hope in difficult times. Her book is called No Straight Road Takes You There, Essays for Uneven Terrain, a collection of pieces she has published over the past few years. Solnit begins with a bracing introduction about history, power, and social change. She draws on the observation by the great historian Howard Zinn that, quote, what leaps out from the history of the past 100 years is its utter unpredictability, end quote. Like, for example, the unexpected overthrow of repressive Eastern Bloc regimes in 1989 by a massive nonviolent uprising. We simply cannot know what the future will bring. No one can say with any certainty what this country will be like in a year or in 5 years. And to claim, as Solnit points out, that you know what the future will bring, that we are destined to live under authoritarian rule, is to give in to despair. And worse, it becomes a way to avoid responsibility for helping to craft a better and more just future for this country and the world. Progressive social change, Solnit argues, has a long trajectory. It tends to originate in the margins, in the periphery of society, although this is so often forgotten, or it is repressed in the short-term memory of the mainstream media, which tends to report change as sudden ruptures, ignoring the long build-up, the fits and starts, the hard work of cultivating a movement. So when President Biden granted student debt relief, it seemed like a sudden gift from on high, when in fact, the idea originated more than a dozen years earlier with the Occupy Wall Street movement. Change, Solnit argues, is indirect, unpredictable, immeasurably slow and subtle. We must recognize the phenomenon of success without victory. Occupy Wall Street did not succeed in tearing down the edifice of capital, but ideas were launched into the world. We still talk about the 1% and that crazy idea of forgiving student debt. We're always in the middle of a story, Solnit writes, but being in the middle, not knowing the ending, is unsettling with its uncertainty and ambiguity. Lastly, Solnit argues, the single most important territory to take is in the realm of the imagination. We must counter the prevailing narratives, in particular, the right-wing vision of humanity as disconnected individuals without mutual obligations, where everyone fends for themselves. Or the idea that only heroes, individuals of extraordinary courage and talent, can effect meaningful change. In fact, Solnit shows, we succeed through alliances, persistence, resistance, and innovation, and the hard work of ordinary people, not heroism. Solnit comes at her argument from many different directions. In the first section of her book, entitled Visions, she looks at more specific examples of positive change, finding inspiration in a 3,000-year-old violin, the meanderings of mushroom hunting, and fairy tales. My favorite chapter is called Insurrectionary Anthood, where she talks about the anti-sewing squad of L.A., which early in the pandemic sewed masks for those who could not afford them. The organization has since grown into a grassroots social justice organization led by women of color. It's an example of the kind of mutual aid that rises up in the context of disasters when the authorities are revealed to be incompetent and inadequate and maybe even uncaring. Mutual aid groups draw on and reinforce our mutuality and interconnectedness. Solnit's second section, titled Revisions, is more analytical in its examination of the ways that our interconnectedness is undermined by dominant narratives. The entire section illustrates the importance of rewriting our stories. Among other issues, she takes up the tech bros of Silicon Valley, the misreading of Darwin, and the importance of not meeting Nazis halfway. My favorite chapter here is titled Against Centrism and Its Biases. The neutrality of the political center is itself a bias, Solnit argues, that promotes a false equivalency between the right and the left. Good people on both sides, as the clown in the White House would have it. Centrism is mostly the bias of people for whom the system is working. Centrism promotes the hopelessly naive idea that if we embrace the center, we'll be one big happy family. But appeasement, as we are witnessing right now, never works. Solnit closes her book with an essay called Toward a Democracy of Voices, in which she calls out the hierarchy of audibility and credibility. It is the voices of the powerful that get heard and their ideas that are granted credibility. This is the ground on which progressive activists must seize territory. Solnit's collection is a welcome corrective to the daily parade of horrors presented in the mainstream media. Her essays are lively and provocative and inspirational. Solnit is no starry-eyed idealist, however, who thinks everything will be all right. But she does provide basis for hope and plenty of reason to resist. If you struggle to answer that simple question from a friend or acquaintance, how are you? If you find yourself drifting into despairing thoughts, this is a book for you. As Solnit points out, despair is a luxury we cannot afford. I'm Patricia Kullberg for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I've been talking about Rebecca Solnit's new book, No Straight Road Takes You There, Essays for Uneven Terrain. I read the news today, oh boy. Just about a bunch of old men with doors to learning how to lead the hard way. But today I'm filled with joy, cause above all of the noise, I'm thinking about the way things could be. And I know in my heart, all we got to do is start, and another world is possible. Yeah, I'm gonna walk around, I wanna make a joyful sound, cause another world is possible.
That was Stephen Smith performing Another World is Possible. And that was Patricia Kullberg discussing Rebecca Solnit's essay collection, No Straight Road Takes You There, Essays for Uneven Terrain, reminding us of the importance of community, of mutual aid, and of the radical margins. Just what you can find here on KBOO Portland, your volunteer-powered, member-supported, nonprofit community radio station. I'm Fran Michelle, reminding you that you can join this community and show your support for KBOO by becoming a member today. Thank you to all of you who are members, whether you've made a one-time donation or are a monthly sustaining member. And thanks to all the monthly sustainers who've been able to increase that monthly donation, even by a couple of dollars a month. You can join us or increase your donation by going to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to 44321. This is the last week of our Camp KBOO summer membership drive, so please give today. Thanks for tuning in, and thanks for listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks to moles and guests Joe Clement, Laurie Mercier, Roberto J. Gonzalez, Desiree Helligers, Ashley Albies, Simab Husseini, Matt Witt, and Patricia Kullberg. Patricia will be back to host next week's Mole with more about artificial intelligence and the left and the law. Stay tuned now to KBOO for Locus Focus with Barbara Bernstein. We'll go out with more of Stephen Smith performing Another World is Possible.
The Boogie Cat. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
It's time to pack your bags and join us for Camp KBOO. Make a